KBOO Portland, volunteer-powered community radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. This month's Development Committee meeting will be held on Monday, January 22nd at 4:30 p.m. The meeting will be held online via a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify a meeting is being held.
Tune in every second and fourth Saturday nights, midnight to 3 a.m. Sounds unsound. Sounds unsound. Only on KBOO. Sounds unsound.
KBOO. To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Flash. This show was recorded just hours prior to a tentative agreement between the GTFF and the U of O.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm your host, Laura Wadlin, with my co-host, Jamie Partridge. Hey, Jamie.
Hey, Laura.
Our topic this evening is Graduate Teaching Fellows Federation Strike Ready. Our guest this evening is Rajiv Ravisankar, former president of GTFF, the Graduate Teaching Fellows Federation, which represents graduate employees at the University of Oregon. Thanks for joining us, Rajiv.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get into your struggles for a union contract, tell our listeners about yourself. How long have you been a graduate teaching fellow? Why did you get active in the union? And what position do you currently hold in the union?
Sure. Again, thanks a lot for having me. I've been a graduate employee at University of Oregon since 2018, so I guess completed 5 years. I became active pretty early on. I actually had picked grad schools to apply to that had unions, just knowing that graduate employee experiences could be challenging. So wanted union protection. So kind of knew that what I was getting into, and then saw that we were in a contract fight that year, my first year as a graduate employee. So got involved as a steward in 2018. And then by 2019, I was actually in leadership as the VP for External Relations, trying to connect with community members and other unions, political reps, and also representing GTFF in the media. Right now, I finished up my time in leadership in 2021 as president. And then I've stayed involved as a member, but also as a delegate for the local labor chapter. So I represent GTFF in the AFL-CIO labor chapter that we have in Lane County.
All right. Well, the Graduate Teaching Fellows Federation has a long history as a union of militant young radicals on the University of Oregon campus, founded in 1975 as one of the country's first graduate teachers unions. The GTFF was riding a wave of student radicalism during the era of the Vietnam anti-war movement, the Black Power, women's and gay liberation movements, and not coincidentally, the early 70s saw a wave of public sector unionization stoked by these militant movements. Public sector unions were legalized in Oregon just 2 years prior to when the GTFF was formed. And still today, the 1,400 member of GTFF proudly display the Red Star, which was has traditionally been associated with socialism in its logo, as it has a track record of almost strikes and strikes over the past 50 years, especially an historic 8-day strike in 2014, winning substantial raises, workload protections, safe and healthy workplaces, fair evaluations, a health and welfare trust, dental insurance, gender identity protection, lowered student fee caps, affordable health insurance for dependents, and a fund for paid medical and parental leave. So on your website, the GTFF Union states that you are fighting for larger campus-wide and community issues. Quote, in recent years, the GTFF has undergone revitalization with increased emphasis on organizing and democratic participation by members of the union. New committees are now looking at health and safety issues, the needs of graduate employees with children, the unique needs of international graduate employees, unquote, and also, quote, fighting for an adequately funded education system accessible for all people, helping to create a revitalized, socially aware union movement as a positive force for change in the entire community. So tell our listeners what these goals mean to you.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for the question. I think what I take from that is, I think with any union, you're always on guard for, falling into a passive model where it's sort of leadership driven and leadership delivers information to members and they're sort of rendered just recipients. And I think we've really been trying to, the last, at least in the time that I've been involved, I'm sure it goes back further, just trying to make sure that folks know that, this is our union. We all make this together. It's a collective project. We are focused on, improving conditions for GEs, for graduate employees at University of Oregon, but that the fight is broader. We should be taking on struggles of working people in our area, in the state, and beyond. And we should be connecting to other working people and other graduate employees around, around the country, really. And that we can cover what we can through our contract, but we know that there are these important fights that extend beyond just given the external forces that are constraining us and putting pressure on all working people. I know we can win great wage improvements in terms of our contract, but the housing situation, for example, has gotten out of control. So we want to sort of engage with our members in a way and engage as a union where we're taking on these struggles. We have great health insurance as graduate employees, but we had a recent hospital closure. So that's an issue for our union to take up. That, look, we have great health insurance, but we need places to use it. We need an emergency department for Eugene. And I think we try to find ways to engage with all of those issues and really take up the mantle of being a community force, something, a union, an organization that really connects with what's going on locally and with activists and other folks who are engaging with sort of working people's interests more broadly.
The GTFF also is awash with caucuses. This is from your website. Caucuses function as spaces where folks with similar interests, concerns, backgrounds, or beliefs can work together on issues that affect them and their community. Currently, active caucuses include Asian and Pacific Islanders, API Caucus, Black Caucus, Disability Access Caucus, Environmental Justice Caucus, GEs of Minority Religions Caucus, International GEs Caucus, Latinx Caucus, Parents Caucus, Queer Caucus, Survivors Caucus, Women's Caucus, and Workers Caucus. What is the importance of caucuses to your union?
I think it's a really important thing to address. We often tell people that when they come in, I think we have a lot of folks who are totally new to unions, and having caucuses actually can serve as an avenue for people to get involved and really take up a mantle of leadership even earlier on than they would otherwise. They serve as an important avenue for new union members to advocate for issues that they care about along identity lines that shape their experiences. What we say is, look, there's so many different ways to be active as a union member. I mean, there are ways that, most people would traditionally identify, talk to your coworkers, have organizing conversations in your department. But then there are these other avenues that we make available for folks and say that, look, you can be a leader of a caucus. You can organize along these lines and activate people who have similar interests and want to advocate both on issues external, sort of campus-based, and then kind of bring those things back to our union in a way that shapes the way that we operate. I think the key for us with so many caucuses is to coordinate, you know, to have strong coordination, to make sure that, you know, if you have so many caucuses that you're on the same page, and really making sure that there's a way that there's inter-caucus coordination and engagement, so that we're encouraging caucuses to do events together and to be able to identify shared interests. So I think there's a way of focusing on specific issues, but also connecting with each other so that you can do joint events and things like that.
All right. Well, today, as we speak, this is a Monday, January 15th. So whenever you're listening to this, understand that we are 2 days away from a possible open-ended strike that GTFF has declared if the University of Oregon administration doesn't come to its senses. So what has brought you to this point, Rajiv, and what are the main bones of contention?
Sure. You know, I think that what graduate employees at UO and around the country have been facing in the last few years is just historic inflation and price pressures, just like other working people. And so we have that scenario of stagnant wages while, you know, costs have really gone up, housing costs and other costs of basic goods have gone up. And it's really created a pinch for graduate employees, some who have families who they're trying to support on a small stipend. I think then that's coupled with kind of a death by a thousand cuts, where you have fees on all kinds of things that the university tries to force you to pay. So your employment is contingent on fees. And so we had these different areas that we wanted to address. I think a living wage was a central part of this campaign. It continues to be sort of the driving force for this campaign, I think, and has become the last thing that we're really fighting over. But I think before that, we've really tried to advocate so that we have reduction in fees, we have more notice for what our employment will look like on a term-to-term basis. Sometimes we don't know even a week before the term what we're going to be teaching or doing heading into that next term. We wanted to make sure to win support for international graduate employees who come, they sort of find themselves in a precarious situation, take on a lot of costs at the front end, and one of those costs is visa fees. And so we won reimbursement for those fees, also access to tax software. That's a challenge that they face. We really tried to look at all the ways that these cuts are playing out, ways that GEs are being affected, where you get money on one hand and you're paying the university back on the other, you're paying some other entity back on the other hand. And so we really wanted to minimize some of those cuts and then really push for a significant wage increase, recognizing that, you know, we needed to claw back, you know, a lot of the losses that we've had. We had a 1 year contract extension during COVID. So our folks are really stuck at one level while costs were going way up. So we saw that what the need was internally, we used the MIT living wage calculator to determine what we should be pushing for. But we were also looking at other unions, you know, in higher ed, especially, and looking at the percentages that they were pushing for and saying that, look, these are possible and we can really win big numbers. And we wanted to make sure to bring those at the minimum salaries for graduate employees up and to start to equalize from bottom to top so you don't have such big disparities and you don't have people coming in on absurd wages that are just unmanageable and unlivable.
How is the university administration responding to the strike threat, and what do you expect from them?
Yeah, I mean, they are responding as you would expect any employer to respond. You know, one of the plans that they have initiated is something that goes back to 2019, something that they've been working on, which is called the Academic Continuity Plan. So this was sort of in the event of an emergency like an earthquake or a GTFF strike, which is along the lines of the language they actually used, that they wanted to make sure that things would go forward without any hindrance, without any with any obstruction at all. That business as usual, like, look, there's a GTFF strike, so we're going to make sure that classes go on as usual. We don't know exactly what that's going to look like because that plan has been in the works, but it hasn't really been tested. But they have an elaborate plan that's coordinated at the university level that really is playing out at the department level in terms of covering our labor when, in the case of a strike. So we'll see what that exactly looks like. It could be staff members covering our labor. It could be temporary or emergency grades being put in by faculty. And it's really with it's intended to just keep the ball rolling, just to ride out a possible strike. They're also posting scab jobs for, replacement workers to come in and take over our work. So, right now I'm a grader in a class. I have to cover 100 students in that class. So, in a scenario like that, why don't you hire an undergrad to do that? Or maybe a graduate student who isn't a graduate employee, someone who's paying out of pocket. Boy, wouldn't that extra money sound nice? So they're posting those positions on a student-facing job portal, trying to hire some of these replacement workers and graders. And that's kind of something we're trying to identify and anticipate and trying to inoculate students around as well. The other last piece is really misinformation on campus about, how our benefits are Cadillac benefits, health insurance benefits are too much, that the ball is in our court. Look, if we just would let go of such a great healthcare that we have, a union managed health insurance, if we could reduce that a little bit, then they could put more into wages. That was a kind of misinformation that they have engaged in for years. I heard from some students, this thing about, well, our tuition benefit is so significant. We're getting so much in tuition remission. When in fact that many of us stopped taking classes after a couple of years. And so they've exaggerated things that we do get, and they've sort of made the situation appear like we already have a big package that takes care of us. And, why are we, we're really we're not justified to push for these kinds of wage increases and kind of making us appear greedy. So I think the misinformation component is significant as well, and they've been doing that with faculty, staff, and students.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to KBOO Portland Labor Radio, an interview with Rajiv Ravi Shankar of the Graduate Teaching Fellows Federation at the University of Oregon. If you like what you're hearing, help us remain a community-sponsored, listener-supported, non-corporate radio station and go to our website and make a donation, kboo.fm.
You mentioned undergraduate students potentially being hired as replacement workers, as scabs. What's the relationship between graduate employees and undergraduate students, and are you involving them in your preparations and push for a fair contract?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Just in terms of in the classroom setting or in research labs, I think the relationship is a really important one because graduate employees are taking on more of the labor. We're often the first people to interact with students. Especially during COVID, we were playing a role way beyond just educator in the classroom. I think we were taking on roles of even providing mental health support, often without much support for ourselves. And so it became, this thing that we are interacting with students far beyond, I think, what was imagined. And that's only increased just given the greater role that graduate employees are playing as just a source of cheap labor on campus. And so in that way, I from graduate employees that I've talked to, they have very close ties often with students, or they're the ones that students feel a little bit more comfortable asking questions to in a discussion section in a large lecture setting, given that that's where we're headed with 200, 300 students in a class. It's much easier to talk to your graduate employee in a discussion section of 20 or 30 rather than going to the lecture and trying to find space in a group of 300. And so in terms of what does that look like from our union's perspective, we've looked at students for quite a while as, as a section that we really need to engage with more. We need to be talking to them. I did a lot of rounds, and I know others have been doing rounds at student group meetings to just do a pitch, say, what's a GTFF strike? What could that look like? Why are we doing it? That we're fighting not just for ourselves, but for a different university, one that works for all of us, and that our working conditions are their learning conditions. And you know, we've really been helped in our coordination with students, or like in our engagement with students, with Young Democratic Socialists of America playing a significant role, with the UO Student Workers, which is a new union for student workers on campus. They've both played an incredibly important role in helping connect us with students that we otherwise wouldn't have connection to, helping us identify which groups to talk to, doing some outreach, even just on their own, and helping us reach many more students, I think hundreds upon hundreds of other students that we may not have been able to just on our own. So I think that additional support from YDSA and from UO Student Workers has been, has been extremely valuable as we've tried to make a final push, a really student-facing push, to let them know what to expect and how they can be in solidarity with us.
So how are you preparing your members to strike, and how does the recent Portland teacher strike, or the University of California graduate workers strike, and other education strikes influence that organizing, that preparation?
Yeah, I mean, I can say for sure that other higher ed strikes and recent bargaining experiences have really shaped our own in terms of, you know, how we were thinking about our demands and thinking about wage percentages to go after. I think looking at other groups of academic workers going on strike gives a sense of confidence. It gives a reference point just about the types of actions you can engage in. I know that we had a general membership meeting where a couple of us led a presentation about the UC strike, the University of California statewide higher ed strike. It's a different model, but there's a lot of lessons to take. And it's just sort of, we've been trying to make a point to bring those into our spaces to inform our members about those examples and those experiences, and try to pull out lessons of, you know, what did it look like on the picket line? What are the types of support networks that they developed? What were, you know, the ways that they had remote involvement, you know, different forms of involvement on the picket line for folks who couldn't actually make it to a physical picket line? Thinking about, you know, how do those unions who've engaged in strikes recently, that have engaged in strikes recently, organize mutual aid? And so I think we've looked at all of those as, you know, really important reference points, while also acknowledging challenges that some of those unions face, so that we can try to anticipate what our scenario would look like. It's been useful for me as someone who's been going to picket lines, so the PAT picket line in Portland, the UAW picket line in Beaverton, just to sort of draw a lesson of what did it look like just on a day-to-day basis. What did food to the picket line look like? What were the other groups that were coming? That has actually been useful for me, at least, to contribute in meetings. And I know others have been in touch with other workers. So I think those have been very useful for us in a tangible way as we've been doing, you know, prep for what our strike HQ looks like, what our picket lines will look like, and really the day-to-day of what a strike would look like.
What are you hoping will be the role of other unions and community members in the campaign?
Yeah, I mean, that was something I think we got a great head start on this year. And I know I worked on a lot of that last time, where, you know, we've had folks really take up this large task of connecting with a range of community organizations, environmental groups, housing groups, any community org in town, you know, that we felt like would was worth engaging with and would be willing to sign a solidarity letter. Some of those same folks actually, you know, were engaging with political representatives, and have been, we've sort of actively been talking to other unions. Like, I've been going to the labor chapter, talking to folks there, giving updates about what bargaining has looked like, and just preparing other unions in town, you know, for the possibility of a picket line, and, you know, just to encourage them to let their members know, and that, you know, we'll be in touch if it comes to it, and to join us. And I think we've had really close coordination with, you know, everyone from nurses unions to building trades to other education workers, you know, just to sort of keep them informed, but also to ask for forms of support. You know, we've talked about coordinated food drop-offs, other forms of support that they could bring us, and just joining the picket line, joining us for rallies as speakers, because we want to show that these kinds of relationships that we have with other unions, and, you know, have them and give them a space really to talk about how our struggles are linked. So we've really tried to incorporate them into our rally planning as well. And I think there are these strategic connections, obviously, in terms of, you know, what are, you know, what are subsets of workers that we can have connections with that point to strategic areas of support that can give us leverage in the context of a strike. So that could be building trades folks, construction workers, and other folks who are on active projects on campus, connecting with them, with you, you know, with folks represented by Teamsters, making sure to make those connections so that if we have active picket lines on campus, that could mean, you know, cascading forms of support that could be strategic sources of leverage for us in relation to University of Oregon. So we hope that all of that work will come to fruition in case of a strike, and really put university administration in, you know, in a pressure situation similar to what they put us in the context of bargaining, to really flip the script and to put them under a lot of pressure so we can have a quicker resolution and to win this fair contract.
So what is your assessment of the Board of Trustees? I assume those are the decision makers, and the prospects for a substantial board backing to win a transformative contract.
Yeah, I know that we had, we made a big push around the last Board of Trustees meeting in December, just to have a big showing, to have our members show up and talk about our fight for a fair contract and the need for a living wage for graduate employees at University of Oregon. We officially can give a union sort of presentation at the board, but at, you know, at the end of the day, you know, the board is not favorable in any way. It sort of works in lockstep with the administration. It's, this is sort of the way the power structure of the university has been operating for years, where you have this so-called independent board, which really works in tandem with what admin wants and with what, like, along the lines of what private donors are looking for. And you have a board chair who's a managing director of a capital management firm. You have multiple charter school proponents, corporate execs and company execs on the board. And so it's hard to say, what's the connection to higher ed? Who, why are these people on this board? Well, I mean, if you think about the board as rubber stamping admin decisions, and really work, I mean, a lot of the votes are unanimous, even with a faculty and a staff representative and soon to be a graduate student representative. You see a lot of unanimous votes on the board and things just kind of chugging along. And that's kind of an area that we've had a hard time making a dent in, about how power is operating, these high decision makers working with the board to go in one direction, which is really towards private donor interests and against workers' interests on campus, student interests on campus. For me, this was, you know, this is something that was demonstrated most clearly in terms of the board operation, just as the pandemic was starting, where they fast-tracked a decision about having the most expensive video scoreboard in a football stadium in the country. The decision they felt that needed to happen just as the pandemic was starting, that they wanted to fast track this decision about a $12 million video scoreboard for Autzen Stadium and to lock in a tuition increase when no one was around. And for me, that's how the board has functioned. And they might have changed the people, they might have changed the language, but even it's sort of, you know, kind of out with the old boss, in with the new boss kind of approach, and the same operation of power continues. So that's something we really have tried to orient around, and we need to build more around. And we're kind of looking at them as certainly not an ally, someone, you know, a group of people that we need to organize around and organize against and overcome to be able to win a fair contract.
You mentioned the connection between board members and higher ed. What's their connection? Well, higher ed is a big source of income and resources for businesses, right? All the research that the graduate fellows do. Very important. So it makes sense they would want to control that. So how will a strike impact students and other university workers and the community, and most importantly, this board, and how will it pressure them to do the right thing?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of students, I think that's the most direct and kind of unclear effect, in terms of it really could shape students experience in different ways is depending on, you know, if they're on scholarship or not and what missing class would look like. And we really asked for students not to cross picket lines in the sense of not going to classes taught by replacement workers, but we also encouraged possibilities of walkouts and more, you know, escalating in terms of their actions in solidarity with us, not to take scab jobs, etc. So, you know, we're sensitive to the fact that it could affect them in ways, you know, related to their circumstances. So, you know, I think it'll have a direct effect given that, you know, we may not be in those classrooms and those classes may not be covered, discussion sections, where places where we're instructor of record. They just won't have that education for the time that we're on strike. And then beyond that, I think, you know, I think we really look at this as a strike that would send a message to administration and the Board of Trustees that their sort of march toward a vision of a fully corporate privatized university that's called public won't go without some resistance and significant resistance.